Welcome to another episode of The Antique Vintager, where each episode, Jeff Eller, The Antique Vintager, discusses vintage items from jewelry, watches, art, and items of vertu in relationship to the times they were made, incorporating history and items in a fascinating way. Remember, just because it's old doesn't make it valuable. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff and Ann Eller.
That's right. It's another episode of The Antique Vintager with Jeff right here. He is going to be talking about clocks, watches, and pocket watches this afternoon, folks. And you'll be able to find this on our page, theantiquevintageremporium.com. Just look for the link to podcasts if you'd like to hear this again, or if you miss it and you want to listen to it, you can always go back and listen there. So, what are we talking about, Mr. Vintager?
We're going to talk about how civilization always has a love for clocks and being able to tell time.
Okay.
And we're going to just go through those fairly quick, but it'll be a background to everything else. The first clocks, of course, were sundials. And they have evidence that the Cro-Magnon man had the analytical ability to stick a stick in the ground and see where the sun would rise or touch it for different areas of as the sun moved through the day and be able to mark it off and used it somehow. And then the sundials became quite prevalent with the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians and the Israelis, and they held sway for about 14,000 years ago, right up to the day there are still sundials. And there were sundials.
Are they accurate?
Yes. And they're in every part of the world, from the Aztecs and Mayas and Incas here in the Americas to the Africans and to the Stonehenge type of application, and the Russians and especially the most sophisticated sundials were made for the Vikings. How about that?
How about that?
And sundials became important even for to do anything in civilization. You had to have be able to put people together at a certain time in a certain place. So they had to have reference to it. And most sundials that were B.C., before Christ, were set up to where you could see them from various angles in the city, the same way as Big Ben was set up in England. Then,
How did they use those now? I mean, you always think of a sundial sitting on the ground, right? Is this, were they on the ground or were they on a wall or how did they use these?
Both.
Both?
They were usually, they were a central figure in any plaza in ancient times.
Right.
Especially market areas. And they were capable of putting them on walls, which made them a central thing for worship in the times that they were set for. Once organized religion came into being, doing certain activities at certain times became a requisite. So they used sundials on sunny days, and on cloudy days, they had something fed by gravity. They turned the thing over, it was an hourglass.
Oh, yes, right.
But that was much later than the initial sundials. Then about 5,000 years ago, the Egyptians and several other societies came up with the fact that you could put a bucket of water on a rope and it would unwind a spiral at a certain speed. And they could correspond it to the sundial. The sundial was the perfection, and this gravity-fed clock was inaccurate, but it was accurate enough. And it was one of the earliest forms of timekeeping, and it only foretold the hours. It didn't have a minutes capability. But then again, it was about 4,000 years old.
Wow.
We come on down, and with the invention of the wheel and the adaptation of the wheel from everything from doing the irrigation or water-driven objects type thing, we used the principle to make a mechanism for clocks. And again, it was driven by water, and it was driven by pre-measured water, and it was driven in a way that it was a mechanism that turned at a certain speed. And we came up with the 60 seconds.
You know, it always fascinates me how people came up with these ideas.
Well, actually, they could measure the amount of time once they knew the element of time that was in a day, because they could use the sundial. And how many beats to the minute did it take to make a full circle?
Sure, but even though we have different calendars, we had the Mayan calendar, we had this calendar. I mean, things were different, and it's just fascinating. I don't want to get off on that because I know you have what you want to talk about, but I do think it's fascinating how they come up with the ideas of time when you really think about it.
Well, the concept of time is something that evolved in every civilization. And every civilization had a calendar.
Wow.
Every civilization.
And they weren't all the same.
Huh?
And they weren't all the same.
And they weren't all the same.
There you go.
Yeah, it's quite unique.
You are so right. So how does this figure into where we're headed here today?
Well, we're just going to give a quick background of why the element of time was so important to man and civilization and industry and production. The next step after was the pendulum, the free swinging weight that would drive a object, a shaft, and they could compensate the shaft for periods of time to mark it off. And for the first time, they had minutes indicated as well as hours. Wow.
Yeah.
And that was that wasn't that far back. That was about 1,500 years ago.
And today we carry around a phone that tells us exactly what time it is.
Right. We still never lost the need for time. The final thing, in around 400 BC, they started with wine clocks. Now, the Greeks in the High Point had clocks that wound, and they wound with a big key. You got to picture this. The modern gear-making equipment that could make tiny gears to drive a watch and things weren't available, and that's the only thing that kept these people from progressing on those. First, you had to have a piece of equipment to make a gear. They could make gears, but the gears were oversized. They were the smallest ones were about 6 inches. So, yes, they could make clocks. Not that accurate, but make clocks. And they combined this wind mechanism with a pendulum to extend the hours that a clock could be run. And then,
because the pendulum actually works as the winding part of the
right.
clock.
It almost rewinds the clock as the energy is dispensed on the clock.
Right.
And clocks back then were one of the most expensive things that you could have. And your clock makers, if you were a king or whatever, you made it to where they couldn't leave your territory.
Well, the other thing is, we had clocks long before we had watches.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, long before. Now, the next step is that they had special times for doing things, and they became predictable times. The Catholic Church set up a certain time for Vespers. The Church also was instrumental in times for Mass, or to ring the bells for to bring people together. Well, they had to have a method of time. The Church was one of the primary ones for time, but military commanders had to have the use of time as they became more sophisticated. The first 1,000 years after the birth of Christ saw a continuation of the Roman capability to produce clocks as they were. Because of the Church, the Catholic Church kept that technology going. And in the East, Muhammad was very big on what time the prayers were, so he had to have a clock system that was portable, much easier than the sundial. And he wanted it to be the same time in Cairo as it is in Baghdad. So if you said 5 o'clock, 5 o'clock meant 5 o'clock anywhere in the caliphate.
Well, that's why eventually they had to get to carriage clocks, right?
Right.
Yeah, so they could do them different times.
Well, the carriage clocks came along a good deal later. By the time the first 1,000 years here after Christ, we had, towards the end of that, we had clocks made that were action clocks. I mean, a vignette came out, a little guy hammering an anvil, or a guy shooting a bow at a bear type thing. And those clocks are still around, and they're still in the great cathedrals. The cathedral season from 1100 to 1500, the great cathedrals were basically built during that period of time. And they all had clock systems. All had clock systems. But during this period of time, they were refining how to make gears. Because, quite frankly, there's no industrial revolution or anything else without the ability to make gears, screws, and washers. All right. The Franciscans in the 1400s decided that clocks were a neat thing to use for proselyting the heathens. And they got entry into China by bringing the emperors of China clocks.
Huh.
Western clocks. And they got, the Franciscans got exclusive in China for about 300 years for supplying a few clocks.
Interesting.
All right. That opened the period with the carriage clock. Now, the carriage clock was usually 4 inches wide and 8.5 inches tall. And it's pretty standard. And it could fit in the same alcove on a carriage as a lantern, which made it useful.
Hmm.
Now, most people have no concept of how a carriage worked. Well, a carriage actually had headlights. Every carriage from time immemorial had some sort of headlights.
Well, they used candles back in the old days?
They used candles. But, you know, how we have access today and say, how on earth could they have done that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had accidents with horses and wagons because they needed light.
Right.
All right, going on down, though, the carriage clock was held sway up through the 1600s. That was about as small a unit as you could have for clocks. And then somebody said, let me make a smaller version to where you could wear it. Well, the first ones that came out were big as a saucer, and you wore it on a chain around your neck, and it was a pretty ostentatious piece of equipment. But it worked, and it was accurate.
And that person was called the timekeeper.
Actually, the person was called the timekeeper.
I didn't know that, folks.
Yeah, you did.
No, I didn't. I was just going along here.
Almost every industrial civilization had the town crier, which was also the town timekeeper. They would call out the status. It's 8 o'clock and all is well. And then covered everything from the news. It's 9 o'clock and the Mongols are at the gate. I mean, this was a status position within the
society.
European cities and society. Now, pocket watches evolved down to by the 1700s, they could fit in a pocket.
Hence, they were called pocket watches.
Pocket watches. And they were called pocket watches in every dialect.
Interesting.
Interesting, right. And clothes were designed around pocket watches.
Well, the suits of the day, and they had the little pocket, you know, right, for the pocket watch. Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth I had all of her dresses made up with a pocket for the pocket watch.
So even women carried pocket watches?
Women wore pocket watches.
Right, around
men
there.
Carried pocket watches, but she scandalized them by having a pocket for her watch.
Interesting. Yeah.
All right. Now, coming on down, we're up to 1700s. Okay, 1700s, Great Britain would not allow a watch industry in the United States. That's part of the things that they complained about on the setup for the Revolutionary War. And after that, immediately after that, watchmakers fled England because of a price differential they could make here in the States. If they were getting $1 an hour in England, they were getting $3 an hour here. And they came to the major port cities from Charleston to Boston and started making watches as a domestic thing. Well, one of the things that they had invented in the 1770s was a gear-cutting machine. And they had steel. And the quality of the steel was such that it could be predictable. And they set up these gear-cutting machines and kept refining them to where the gears could be smaller and smaller and smaller. And therefore, the watches got reasonably small. And there's a lot of interpretations there. And we're talking about watches that were made out of gold, watches that were made out of silver. Quite a few were made out of silver because they wouldn't tarnish. And they were used as an accessory. It's much the same as the Rolex is today. You pull out your watch and people looked at it and say, ooh, wow. All right. Now, from 1820 to 1890, the watch industry in the United States grew so fast and so big that it was the number one employer in 1890. Number one employer.
Wow.
It had like 3 million people working in the watch industry. Elgin alone had 600,000.
Didn't you tell me that women were paid the same as men back then because of their desirability to work in the watch industry?
Well, it's coming to that. That was one of the first equal pay for equal work done. And women did 4 tasks that they declared men unfit for. One was,
I can think of a few more, folks, but never mind.
One was making the dials of these pocket watches. The inscriptions, the things, these
the
are
delicate poor, work that they did.
It was extremely delicate work, and it was extremely valuable work. Women also help with the engraving. and a woman engraver sitting right alongside of a man made the exact same money.
Which they should have.
Which they should have.
But traditionally don't.
Right. In almost any other industry, they did not. Now, the equipment that were designed to be able to make watches, from doing the porcelain dolls to cutting out the hands to doing the gears to packaging the oil, which, would, by the way, was whale oil, were such that it let all the other industries that you could think of that were commercial, meaning things like adding machines, typewriters, all would never have come about without the machinery dedicated to making watches.
Hence the importance of time.
Now, there's one other thing that here in the United States drove the importance of time. We had an extensive railroad system. The only other nation that had a railroad system even compared to us was India. But our railroad system was constantly having wrecks because of two trains on the same track at the same time. So they got together and had a Congress of railroad executives and legislators and regulators, and they came up with a degree of accuracy that your watch had to have. And it became known as the railroad grade. And so the high-end watch industry, not just plain watches, but the high-end watch industry based on accuracy was born. And that from about the 1890s all the way up through the 1970s was a composite thing for the watch industry, but it was a level playing field. Everybody had to reach that degree of perfection or it wasn't qualified to be called a railroad grade. And that, coupled with setting up the different time zones, cut the accidents in the railroad industries from something like a couple of thousand a year down to less than 150 in the very first year that they were using accurate watches and the time zones.
That's amazing, and we're going to have to finish up. You'll have to do another one when we move forward. But I think the thing that's also very interesting is today railroad pocket watches are still very much in demand.
I buy what I can of them, and I sell all I have of them. So that means they're in much demand.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, they are still marvels of engineering even today. And the watch can be 100 years old. It can be 120 years old. It can be 50 or 60. But a railroad-grade watch is a marvel of engineering.
That's right. So to wrap up another antique vintager right here on WCRS, what would you like to be your closing comments today?
I'd like to just tell people it doesn't matter that your watch doesn't run, hasn't run for 50 years. Bring it to me. It still has probable value. Now, some are just too far gone. But a lot of ones I've seen where people were going to chuck them out because it didn't run, I have bought. And I bought them everything from $20 to $2,000. So bring it on in.
Bring it on in. Right here to the Antique Vintager, 637 Durst Avenue East. That's right. The Antique Vintager is in the building. Don't forget, you can check out our website, see all our time-remembered items from clocks, watches, and pocket watches right there at the Antique Vintager Emporium.com. And look for the podcast. It will be up, I would say, by Tuesday. This latest podcast will be on the Antique Vintager Emporium under podcast. Don't forget, 30% off everything on the site. Make sure you check it all out. Pick yourself a bargain. Pick yourself a deal. It's our way of celebrating the Festival of Flowers right here in Greenwood. That's going to do it for us. Thanks so much, everybody. Thanks very much, Vintager, for stopping by and educating and enlightening us.
Okay, it was fun.
All right, that'll do it for us. Bye-bye, everybody. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Antique Vintager. Make sure to visit our website, theantiquevintageremporium.com, for video clips and pictures of the show, as well as lots of merchandise. Jeff also looks forward to your questions and comments. While you're on the website, theantiquevintageremporium.com, don't forget to sign up for email notifications. Tune in next week for The Antique Vintager. Bye-bye!